Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 579, titled, Give Me a Break, Reflections on the Death of Gerald Ford. This has been recorded on January 7th of the year 2007. Well, Happy New Year, For the Record listeners. There is a great deal going on, and I have an awful lot of material stacked up, sort of waiting in the wings, but I thought that we would begin the first broadcast of the new year by reflecting on the death of Gerald Ford. Ford passed away, of course, recently, and the media have been filled with hagiographies about Gerald Ford's career, talking about him as a Norman Rockwell painting come to life, and talking about how he helped, as he said in his first public speech after assuming the presidency, that he has he'd helped to end our national nightmare, which is how Gerald Ford referred to Watergate. In fact, anyone who thinks that Gerald Ford helped to end our long national nightmare is dreaming. He's much more like a George Lincoln Rockwell painting come to light. George Lincoln Rockwell was the Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose Arlington, Virginia name and address were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. And we're going to take a look at Gerald Ford's performance vis-a-vis Watergate and the assassination of President Kennedy. Let's begin by taking a look at an article which originally was published in the Washington Post. It's by Bob Woodward. It was republished in the San Francisco Chronicle under the title How Ford Stood by Real Friend Nixon. It reads in part, months before Richard Nixon set Michigan Congressman Gerald Ford on the path to the White House, Nixon turned to Ford, who called himself the embattled president's only real friend, to get him out of trouble. During one of the darkest days of the Watergate scandal, Nixon secretly confided in Ford, at the time the House Minority Leader. He begged for help. He complained about fair-weather friends and swore at perceived rivals in his own party. Tell the guys, goddammit, to get off their A-blank-blank and start fighting back, Nixon pleaded with Ford in one call recorded by the president's secret taping system. And Ford did. Quote, anytime you want to do anything under any circumstances, you give me a call, Mr. President, he told Nixon during that May 1, 1973 conversation. We'll stand by you morning, noon, and night. And still later, on April 6, 1971, for example, Nixon called Ford to find out what was going on with House Majority Leader Hale Boggs, Democrat of Louisiana. Boggs had just taken to the House floor saying that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was regularly wiretapping members of Congress, and Nixon wanted to know why Boggs was going public. Well, Hale Boggs, like Gerald Ford, had been a member of the Warren Commission. That was the Presidential Fact-Finding Commission set up ostensibly to investigate, but actually to cover up, President Kennedy's assassination. Gerald Ford, as we will see in a minute, was actually J. Edgar Hoover's informant on the Warren Commission, keeping Ford apprised of everything that was going on. Hale Boggs, however, was a dissenter. He felt that the Warren Commission was deceived by various people, including J. Edgar Hoover, and that, in fact, an assassination conspiracy had been successfully covered up. Hale Boggs, we should note, was killed in a plane crash, the crash of a private plane, not too long after this particular period of time, and the exact cause of that crash has never been successfully investigated, but Boggs was killed. Not so Gerald Ford. Now, as we've seen in many broadcasts, at the core of the Watergate scandal was the Kennedy assassination. To make a long story short, what Richard Nixon was afraid of if the Watergate cover-up unraveled was that the, quote, Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, would come out. As we're going to see, that was a code name in the Nixon White House for the assassination of President Kennedy. And his reluctance to release the Watergate, the tapes from the White House taping system, was because of the fact that he feared it would break open, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, i.e., the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to begin the substance of this broadcast by listening to an excerpt from the old One Step Beyond show that I used to do. This is an addendum to The Guns of November, Part 3. This segment that you're going to hear was recorded in June of 1972, and The Guns of November, Part 3, the original broadcast, was recorded on November 15, 1983. This information, in turn, is contained in a miscellaneous archive show, number M59, titled Richard Nixon's greatest hits. What you're going to listen to is first the reading and discussion of an excerpt from Bernard Fensterwald's Coincidence or Conspiracy, discussing the fact that Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, and lied to the FBI about it in February of 1964, claiming that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas was 2 days before the assassination. You're also going to hear an excerpt from a UPI article from November 22, 1963, quoting Richard Nixon in Dallas on November 21st, a day after he told the FBI he left. Then you're going to listen to an excerpt from H.R. Bob Haldeman's book, The Ends of Power. Bob Haldeman was one of Nixon's top aides, and he discusses, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing and the fact that in the Nixon White House, the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a code word for President Kennedy's assassination. The third piece of reading, the final piece of reading, I should say, in what you're about to hear, is an excerpt from Penn Jones' Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, in which Penn Jones, the late editor of the Midlothian Mirror in Texas, ruminates about why Nixon was in Dallas on 11/22, or in that time period. Penn Jones speculates that Nixon attended a meeting along with J. Edgar Hoover at independent oil man Clint Murchison's house the night before the assassination, and that this was a final go meeting, so to speak, a planning session, the final planning session for the assassination. So here again, from One Step Beyond and from The Guns of November Part 3 and from M59 is the segment that I talked about. I'm going to begin this addendum to The Guns of November Part 3 by reading some sections from a book called The Ends of Power that was authored by former Nixon aide H.R. Bob, as he was known, Haldeman, H-A-L-D-E-M-A-N, and this was written with Joseph DiMona, capital D-I, capital M-O-N-A. It was copyrighted 1978 and published in hardcover in that year by New York Times Books. Now, the thing that Richard Nixon was looking to keep covered up vis-a-vis the Watergate scandal was what he referred to often as, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Richard Nixon did not want to disclose or did not want to release the Watergate tapes because he was worried that releasing the Watergate tapes and the disclosure of the scandal might, quote, blow the whole Bay of Pigs thing open. Now, in The Ends of Power, Bob Haldeman reveals that the Bay of Pigs thing, quote-unquote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, was a well-known code word in the Nixon White House for the Kennedy assassination. Well, that basically was what Richard Nixon was referring to. Now, Haldeman and Joseph DiMona write in The Ends of Power, "So we had failed in our one previous attempt to obtain CIA cooperation, and now in Ehrlichman's office on June 23, 1972, the CIA was stonewalling me again. Quote, not connected, unquote. Quote, no way, unquote. Then I played Nixon's trump card. Quote, the president asked me to tell you this entire affair may be connected to the Bay of Pigs, and if it opens up, the Bay of Pigs may be blown. Turmoil in the room. Helms, that's former CIA Director Richard Helms, gripping the arms of his chair, leaning forward and shouting, quote, the Bay of Pigs had nothing to do with this. I have no concern about the Bay of Pigs, unquote. Silence. I just sat there. I was absolutely shocked by Helms' violent reaction. Again, I wondered, what was such dynamite in the Bay of Pigs story? Finally, I said, quote, I'm just following my instructions, Dick. This is what the president told me to relay to you, unquote. Skipping down. Years later, former CBS correspondent Dan Shore called me. He was seeking information concerning the FBI investigation Nixon had mounted against him in August of 1971. Shore later sent me his fascinating book, Clearing the Air. In it, I was interested to find that evidence he had gleaned while investigating the CIA finally cleared up for me the mystery of the Bay of Pigs connection in those dealings between Nixon and Helms. It's intriguing when I put Shore's facts together with mine. It seems that in all those Nixon references to the Bay of Pigs, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination. And that is interesting because that is what, according to Bob Haldeman, Nixon was worried about in connection with Watergate, that the whole Bay of Pigs thing might come out. One of the possibilities that has to be very, very seriously considered is that among the many, many losers, if the true story of President Kennedy's assassination ever came out, might indeed be Richard Nixon himself. I'm reading now from a book called, I'm going to reread from sections of a book called Coincidence or the Assassination of President Kennedy, Coincidence or Conspiracy. This was authored by Bernard Fensterwald, Jr., and he, interestingly enough, was the defense attorney for James McCord, one of the Watergate burglars and the individual who, in all probability, betrayed the team, as they used to refer to themselves, inside the Watergate Hotel.
That, of course, is where Democratic National Party headquarters were. This book was published in softcover by Zebra Books of the Kensington Publishing Corporation, and it was copyrighted 1977. In this book, it discusses, and we talked about this in the original installment of The Guns of November, in this book there is discussion of Richard Nixon's curious behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of John Kennedy. Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas from November 20th through November 22nd of 1963 in his role as an attorney for PepsiCo, the parent company of Pepsi-Cola. And Bernard Fensterwald writes about Richard Nixon as follows. Richard M. Nixon, who was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, left the city a couple of hours before the Kennedy assassination occurred, and he later told the FBI that he hadn't been in Dallas at all that day. Later still, Richard Nixon also gave an inaccurate accounting of what he had when he had actually arrived in Dallas. Skipping down, during his FBI interview on February 28, 1964, Nixon inaccurately stated that he'd left Dallas on November 20th rather than on November 22nd. An FBI report contained in Warren Commission Exhibit 1973 states the following. On February 28, 1964, the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the U.S., was contacted by Assistant Director in charge of the New York office, John F. Malone, and furnished the following information. Mr. Nixon advised that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas during 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So Richard Nixon, who of course was defeated in the 1960 presidential race by John Kennedy, when interviewed just 3 months after the assassination on February 28th of 1964, claimed that he had left Dallas, Texas on November 20th, 2 full days before he actually did. One of the truisms of the assassination of John Kennedy is that everyone who was of the age of consciousness when they heard Kennedy was killed remembers exactly where they were and what they were doing. That apparently does not include Richard Nixon. The fact that Richard Nixon's role vis-a-vis the Kennedy assassination has not received more public scrutiny than it has is all the more interesting because the New York Times of November 22, 1963 carries a UPI story, Dateline Dallas, on November 21st, 1963, which quotes Richard Nixon. Now, remember that Nixon told the FBI just 3 months after the assassination that he had left Dallas, Texas on November 20th. Well, this UPI story in America's paper of record, the New York Times, quotes Nixon in Dallas a day after he claims he left, or that he claimed he left when interviewed by the FBI. This article reads, former Vice President Richard M. Nixon, on a business trip to a city President Kennedy visits tomorrow, said today the 1964 Republican nominee must beat Mr. Kennedy on his record, not on personalities. Quote, his public relations is tremendous, Mr. Nixon said, but his performance is poor. Mr. Nixon said the Republican nominee must attack Mr. Kennedy on his record of non-achievement, his, quote, brave talk but no action, unquote, deterioration of foreign policy toward Latin America and Southeast Asia, and, quote, what is apparently our permanent unemployment, unquote. Mr. Nixon said Mr. Kennedy's failure to handle Congress, where he has a 2-to-1 majority, quote, shows his lack of leadership much better than anything else, unquote. He again denied that he would seek the Republican nomination, but he said, quote, I am going to work as hard as I can to get the Kennedys out of there. We can't afford 4 more years of that kind of administration, unquote. Well, among the things that we have looked at in various archive shows, including the aforementioned Guns of November Part 3, is that President Kennedy was in the process of withdrawing the United States from Vietnam. That was one of many things that got him killed. He also was in the process of achieving a diplomatic rapprochement with Cuba. Nixon had long-standing political ties to the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, which, of course, was inextricably linked with the CIA and organized crime. So certainly a diplomatic rapprochement with Castro was not something that would have sat well with Richard Nixon. We covered that in Radio Free America program number 12 in considerable detail. Now, the question remains, why did Richard Nixon dissemble concerning his presence in Dallas on 11-22-63, certainly he could not have left Dallas on November 20th when he was interviewed by UPI in Dallas on November 21st. A speculative but very possible account of what Nixon was doing in Dallas and why he lied about it is carried in a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. That's authored by Penn Jones, Jr., one of the best and earliest of the critics of the Warren Commission, one of the best researchers, and this was published privately by the Midlothian Mirror, or actually it was published by the Midlothian Mirror and copyrighted 1969 in soft cover. And interestingly enough, this book has an account And by the way, Penn Jones was a journalist with the Midlothian Mirror, and that is a suburb of Dallas, Texas, and he was in a position to begin investigating the Kennedy assassination from the ground level, so to speak, almost at once. By the way, the title, a number of people have wondered where the title comes from. The title of Forgive My Grief, and there are four volumes in all, comes from a poem in memoriam by Alfred Lord Tennyson, a portion of which reads, Forgive my grief for one removed, thy creature whom I found so fair. I trust he lives in thee, and there I find him worthier to be loved. And interestingly enough, in Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, Penn Jones presents an account that Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were at a party by Texas oil magnate Clint Murchison, M-U-R-C-H-I-S-O-N. According to Robert Depew, the head of the Minutemen, Clint Murchison was the number one financier of the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and phone number were in Oswald's address at the time of his arrest. The speculation here by Penn Jones is that Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were at the Murchison party as part of an executive go conference on the assassination of Kennedy. In other words, the final plans for the go-ahead were made at this party, although, as he speculates, not in the presence of most of the party goers. In Forgive My Grief, Volume 3, Penn Jones writes as follows, talking about the society, parties of wealthy Dallas society that were held at Clint Murchison's home. Penn Jones says, an earlier unreported Murchison party was much more important than those of recent years. This party was held on the night of November 21st, 1963, at the Murchison home, and we think was the cover for an important conference of the assassination staff. We have always felt sure that before the president was killed, a staff conference was held somewhere, and all the elements of the assassination plot were present or represented. For a time, we thought the conference was held in Sykes, Louisiana. There were some planning meetings held in Sykes for some of the lower-level operatives, but not the big meeting just before the hit. When it is realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was even more important than the Normandy invasion with General Eisenhower in command, then the conference for the Dallas Project becomes essential. The killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of a country in our world history. All the major forces in this country were involved and had to be accounted for at the final conference before the strike. So a conference was necessary, and the conference was held. Since Richard M. Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murchison home that night, we feel we should report that the conference was held there in the home, not in the presence of the partygoers, to be sure, but on the premises. And skipping down, admittedly, our information about Hoover's presence was learned secondhand, but it is reliable. We will never tell how we got the information. Well, that obviously is a speculative account, but one which I think certainly warrants serious examination. I think we can assume that Richard Nixon was lying in his teeth when he told the FBI that he left Dallas on November 20th. There's no way that his memory could have been off by a full 48 hours within 3 months. So he was lying about something, and it seems probable that he was involved in Kennedy's assassination in some way, whether it was, as Penn Jones has speculated, at a go conference, so to speak, with J. Edgar Hoover at the home of Clint Murchison or not. It does appear that Nixon was probably involved in some way or another, as were many other people who participated in some way in the Watergate scandal.
That again, from The Guns of November Part 3, recorded in June of 1972. That is also included in Miscellaneous Archive Show M59, Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits, from May 1st of 1994. Now next, we're going to hear some very interesting information about the Watergate tapes themselves. Now recall that again, what Richard Nixon was afraid of if the Watergate tapes were released and the Watergate cover-up unraveled was that the, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, i.e. the assassination of President Kennedy, would come out. When the Watergate tapes were finally released, there turned out to be a number of gaps. The most famous of those was an 18-and-a-half-minute gap in which Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, alleges she accidentally hit the record pedal and erased the tape. Many people were skeptical about that. Interestingly enough, Rosemary Woods retained Charles Rhine, a former Warren Commission legal advisor, as her counsel in the case she faced charges. What we're going to listen to next is an excerpt from Intern, for the record program number 253 from October 15th of 2000, and Intern yet again, an excerpt from The Guns of November Part 3 from November 15th of 1983, going back again almost a quarter of a century into the archives. We're going to be hearing about the erasing of the Watergate tapes or proposals to do that. First of all, in yet another excerpt from Bernard Fensterwald's Coincidence or Conspiracy, we're going to hear about White House counsel Charles Colson consulting with Gordon Novell, a formidable veteran intelligence agent and electronic counterintelligence specialist, about the feasibility of erasing the Watergate tapes. Novell has enigmatically denied having done that and claims that actually Colson was consulting with him to get information about the origins of Title III, under which the indictments that were returned in the Watergate scandal were against the burglars themselves. Those indictments were under what became Title III. But you're going to hear first from Bernard Fensterwald and his allegation that Chuck Colson solicited Gordon Novell, one of the key figures in Jim Garrison's investigation into the assassination, to study the feasibility of erasing the Watergate tapes. Then you're going to hear an enigmatic statement by Gordon Novell in a letter to Technology Review in which he makes a reference to his ultra-high technology role in erasing the Watergate tapes. This again from For the Record 253 and also from The Guns of November Part 3 from November 15th of 1983. What we're going to do in order to gain some perspective on propositions that the Nixon White House came up with to erase the tapes, and in particular an individual who figured in Jim Garrison's investigation and whose name crops up in connection with White House aide Charles Colson's proposition to erase the Watergate tapes, we're going to revisit the archives, and we're going to go back to November 15th, 1983, and The Guns of November, Part 3. In addition to my own voice, in the excerpt you're about to listen to, you will hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. This, again, is from The Guns of November, Part 3, November 15th, 1983, and the discussion will resume begin in the middle of an analysis of a number of figures that Jim Garrison tried to have extradited to New Orleans in order to pursue his investigation, but who for one reason or another did not wind up in New Orleans. This again from The Guns of November, Part 3.
Now, the third of the would-be the third of the people that Garrison tried to have extradited and was unable to do so was a guy named Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. Now, Novell was affiliated with the same anti-Castro, CIA-sponsored right-wing milieu in New Orleans in the South that we've been talking about. Now, he also was affiliated with the Bannister's, quote, detective agency, unquote. And Novell had deposed to Garrison in connection with an arms theft case connected with Bay of Pigs that a whole bunch of munitions taken from the Schlumberger company intended for use by the Bay of Pigs Brigade against Castro had been stored overnight in Guy Bannister's detective agency. Again, this second floor walk-up with two addresses, one to right-wing Guy Bannister, one to alleged left-winger Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Garrison wanted to question Gordon Novell in connection with the Kennedy case. Novell split for Ohio, and Garrison filed an extradition request to then-Governor of Ohio John Rhodes. Is it John Rhodes? I know there was the minority leader was John Rhodes from Arizona, and it was Governor Rhodes of Ohio.
I believe it's Governor John Rhodes.
Rhodes. Anyway, Governor Rhodes, first name we may be wrong on, but Governor Rhodes of Ohio, and I think it's John Rhodes. Basically, he agreed to extradite Gordon Novell on the condition that Jim Garrison would not question him about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, this is absurd, of course, because that was the very thing that Garrison was attempting to have Novell extradited in order to question him in connection with. So the governor of Ohio says, yeah, we'll grant the extradition request if you don't question him about the thing you want to question him about. And so that's who this fellow Gordon Novell is now. Pick up on his connections to Watergate.
That's right. That slays me. No pun intended. Okay, this little section we're reading here is from a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations under the direction of Bernard Fensterwald, Jr., coincidentally enough, James McCord's lawyer at a later point, and compiled by Michael Ewing. This particular book is published by Zebra Books, Kensington Publishing Corporation. It's copyright 1977. This We're going to start out talking about Charles Colson, but Gordon Novell will crop up very quickly. Charles Colson, President Nixon's special counsel and widely hated hatchet man from 1969 to 1973, was the man who originally selected E. Howard Hunt to set up the secret White House plumbers. Colson, with a single exception of H.R. Haldeman, seems to have been involved in more of the horrors of the Nixon Rogues Gallery than any other aide. During his years with Nixon, Colson attained a well-deserved reputation as one of the meanest, most slippery, and dangerous men ever to serve in American government. Nixon himself had once remarked, quote, Colson would do anything. Colson had once been involved with one of Jim Garrison's former, quote, suspects in a mysterious plan to erase the Nixon Watergate tapes in March of 1974. This strange information first came to the surface in August of 1974, when Jack Anderson disclosed that Colson had met with New Orleans electronics specialist Gordon Novell in March 1974 and had begun developing plans for the magnetic erasure of various Nixon tapes. Novell, who had received national attention in 1967 as District Attorney Garrison's, quote, missing witness, when he was under investigation for his reported contacts with both David Ferry and Clay Shaw. Novell and Colson discussed the use of an experimental degaussing machine, which could project a magnetic beam into the Nixon tapes and erase them without having to handle them in any way. Anderson reported that Colson had described some of the tapes as containing conversations that, quote, could cause the president's grief, and that Novell recalled that Colson had also spoken of using the erasing machine to obliterate some secret recordings maintained by the CIA as well. Following his discussion with Colson in March of 1974, Gordon Novell flew to Texas to see an associate and drew up a blueprint for the erasing plan, which he cryptically referred to as, quote, the El Paso matter, when he later sent the blueprint to Colson by hand courier in Washington. Colson claimed that the whole erasing idea was just, quote, a joke, and that he had discussed the plan only for, quote, a little bit of comic relief. Okay, well, without confusing you by trying to give you too much more on the Watergate thing itself, just bear that in mind. Here's Gordon Novell, a former Jim Garrison extradition request denied by John Rhodes unless they would agree not to talk to him about the very thing they wanted to extradite him for. Gordon Novell crops up in Watergate trying to help Charles Colson, allegedly trying to help Charles Colson erase the Watergate tapes. Colson, on the other hand, turns around and calls it, quote unquote, a joke, okay? Now, this next two little bits here real quickly. This is something we ran across just a couple of years ago with help from Mae Brussel, who found this for us, and we used it on One Step Beyond, and we're going to repeat it here. This is from Technology Illustrated magazine, and it's the April 1983 edition. Okay, and this first little bit is just a little introduction to an article, and it's written by, you know, somebody on the staff, and they're just introducing the article, and they say, last summer for spy tech, and this is meaning like summer of 82, so this is pretty recent, last summer four spy tech luminaries gathered at a private 60-acre camp in Powder Springs, Georgia. Mitch Werbel, the host, known in military circles as, quote, the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, Gordon Novell, a New Orleans entrepreneur and reputed offshore arms merchant, sometimes referred to as the Mad Bomber, Gordon Liddy, star of Watergate and his own autobiography, Will, and Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bell, U.S. Army, retired, one of the world's acknowledged experts in the field of electronic spycraft. Okay, now, that's just the intro that they use, mentioning Gordon Novell as being present with Liddy at Mitch Werbel's ranch, and Mitch Werbel's camp, actually, is what it is, and calling him and mentioning that he's sometimes known as the Mad Bomber. Now, interestingly enough here, in the Technology Illustrated for July of 1983, Mr. Novell takes pen in hand or typewriter in hand to write an article, to write a letter in himself. In the midst of his letter, where he is talking about different things, he says, quote, the only people, this is Gordon Novell himself, by the way, writing in response to that introduction in the article. He says, quote, the only people who have ever had the fortitudinal stupidity to call me, quote, the Mad Bomber, are all now defendants in two ongoing federal civil suits totaling well over $2 billion in damages. This one-man war resulted mainly from my ultra-high technology counterintelligence role in Watergate to erase the White House tapes.
That again from For the Record 253 and in turn from The Guns of November Part 3 from November 15th of 1983. On side two, we're going to take up yet again the subject of the gaps in the Watergate tapes and the enigmatic comments that have been made either in print and or vocally by the formidable Gordon Novell. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 579, Give Me a Break. Reflections on the Death of Gerald Ford. This is being recorded on January 7th of the year 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.